and Healthcare Reform. This is April 2nd, 2007. Thank goodness it's not April 1st, 2007. I mean, we have enough April Fools going on around here without us adding to it. This is House Room 50, and we're going to have an informational meeting tonight and some public testimony. We'd like to start with, now, I hope I'm not going to get these names wrong, Jim Quaid. Reese Sailors up first. Oh, yeah. Okay. Reese Sailors, Office of the Governor. Sorry about that. Hi, Reese.
Hello.
Okay.
How are you?
I'm fine. My good staff has just reminded me that on Wednesday night, when we normally would be here, we're going to be up in Oregon City with the Four Ways and Means Committee, so you all have a night off. Okay, please enjoy. We'll be thinking of you. Reese, identify yourself, please, for the camera.
Okay, for the record, I'm Reese Sailors, the Governor's Health Policy Advisor, and I'm delighted to be with you. Hello, Mother. Okay. Tell me if you can't hear me. I'm delighted to be here on behalf of the governor. He happens to be in New Orleans or in transiting back here from New Orleans. And I've been asked to share with you his letter that he has sent to Senator Bates, Senator Westland, and also former Governor Kitzhaber, and also Representative Greenlick. And first of all, I think the governor wants to say to you, thank you for your effort and your, I don't want to say endless meetings, but your tireless meetings.
Endless.
On the topic of where we need to go in the future with our health care system. We agree that the status quo is not adequate to our long-term needs, and that we need to encourage the kind of discussion that you are leading and see it as an opportunity for us to find ways to ultimately expand coverage, control the costs, and improve the quality of care. You know, I think everybody wants, knows that the system isn't right, but I think also the public shares with each other the fear that they might lose what they have. So the fear of what you might not have as well as what you do have or could get is very much a steering current among the public. And also there's talk about employer sponsorship in this system, and employers have been a pillar to our healthcare system in terms of the dollars that they provide into the system to help us finance healthcare. And I think sometimes we overlook that as one of the main sources of, if you wish, financing or subsidy, depending on how you want to look at it. But by the same token, as you well know, employers are struggling to maintain that benefit and to own up to their responsibility for providing benefits to their workers. And those employers who are unable to provide coverage are blocked by two things. One, their fear of what the future costs would be, as well as their sense of inability to afford the current costs. So I think part of what we want to say is that we want to exploit the momentum that you've created and try and use it to actually move us forward in this process, and I know we all share that. There's also the tremendous commonality that I've heard you speak about in your meetings between the commission, Representative Greenlick's pieces, your work, the Oregon Business Council, and Governor Kitzhaber. And I think part of what the governor wants to emphasize with you is while we need to look at this longer-term issue, he does not want to, for us to allow that to distract us from the immediate issues, which are healthy kids, restoring part of the OHP standard population, and the prescription drug program expansion as well. These things are clearly available to us, practical, pragmatic, and we don't want to have them shadowed by this conversation and see this as a part and parcel of the steps we need to take along the road and steps that are immediately available to us and need to be made a reality. And then I think beyond the immediate steps that, or the immediate things that we see, there are some tenets about the longer-term healthcare reform that the governor wanted to share with you. First of all, he believes in the concept of aggregated purchasing power. And I think the conversations that I've heard you have and others as well about an insurance exchange are very appealing to the governor. It makes sense. My personal experience with these types of purchasing arrangements are that they have the opportunity to take, if you look at this, if you're a marketplace person, which sometimes I am and other times I'm not, but in the marketplace for healthcare, what we see is happening right now is the organizing of purchasers, large purchasers, beginning to do what we call value purchasing, which is a nice umbrella that takes into account things like transparency. But Senator Westland asked a couple of weeks ago, can somebody give me a single syllable definition of what we mean by value purchasing? And my definition is the best bang for the buck. Those are all single syllables, and that's really what value purchasing is about. It's getting the right care to the right person at the right time in the right setting. And by right, I mean also effective. So I think the idea of that, and it allows purchasers, particularly in the individual and small business, small group market, to participate in what they cannot participate in right now, which is that drive among larger purchases to begin to demand change from the delivery system and through the issues of value purchasing. If you think about it right now, you have folks like Nike and people like that who are, and RPEB, who are beginning to exercise in their procurement and contracting behaviors certain demands for outcomes, certain demands for measurements, certain demands of accountability. The small group and individual markets are unable to do that because, and I always use the analogy, it's kind of like a bag of marbles without a bag. They're all over the place. They don't have a leveraging point. They don't have a central speaking point or a place to speak from. And so one of the things, one of the beauties of an exchange-type mechanism is not only does it provide the opportunity to have leveraged buying power and some of the economies of scale that you might get from that, but it also allows a huge segment of the market that is left out of those conversations about accountability, outcomes, value, quality, et cetera, kind of thing. They are left out of that conversation and unable to put their buying power to that wheel that we're all trying to push. I think also as we see the exchange being discussed here, Massachusetts, other states around the country, part of what we see too is that the exchange has the ability to speak to portions of the population that represent large segments of our uninsured population too. For instance, one of the things that the exchange can deal with is the self-employed individual or the person who has multiple part-time jobs. Frequently right now, maybe some of those part-time employers would be willing to give some, but not all of a premium contribution towards coverage. An exchange could be a vehicle through which that type of arrangement could be administered. It currently doesn't exist in the market today. And if you look at the data on who are the uninsured, they're overwhelmingly people who work, people who are self-employed, people who work for small businesses who can't afford to provide them with coverage. So once again, it provides a good vehicle for those people as well. I think we all imply that everyone would get coverage, and I think we've talked about the idea of a mandate, but we also recognize that if everyone is to be covered, then there is a responsibility on the part of the state to make sure that those who cannot afford are provided with assistance so that they can afford. And I think sometimes there are analogies drawn to car insurance. I would point out to you that property and casualty insurance is different from health insurance, and I think there are ways that we can both assist people in affording it so that you don't have the same kind of uncoverage figures that you have in car insurance, and also there are ways that we can keep tabs on it if we have to. I think if you think about bringing everybody into coverage, then it also presents some opportunities for us around, I think, administrative simplification in the system. When you think about everybody being in, then some of the time and costliness that we have in the system that relate to risk selection, underwriting, et cetera, tends to be no longer as essential to the system as it is today, that there's no avoidance of the risk. What you're really talking about in that instance potentially is after the fact looking at what was the draw of the lot and doing a post-risk adjustment for those who drew an extraordinarily sick population, one plan or the other. And that technology is available to us and is being used elsewhere in the country as well. I think the other pieces, and you've touched on these as well, that we could define affordability and we could also use the exchange to administer subsidies in whatever form they may take. And they may take a variety of forms. Some may be a direct to the individual, but there are very interesting subsidy mechanisms that have been developed in other states, for instance, related to some of the reinsurance. I think immediately of New York, where the state has assumed an interior corridor of risk, as they call it. The cost of that per year per person enrolled in that program is merely around $600. The program is now a good 5 years old, and it represents the ability, by taking that risk on, the state of New York has been able to drop the premium cost to the buyer, to the small business person, by about 40%, which begins to bring it into the arena of affordability. For example, let's say the monthly premium was $200 a month, and we arranged for an internal corridor, a risk assumption, from $5,000 to $75,000, and shared that with the plans on a 90-10 basis, like in New York, then part of what you get for that is that the price of that premium now, as it presents to the would-be employer who is going to buy insurance for the first time, is now no longer $200, but he's now looking at, I believe, $120, which he then in turn may say, well, I need to split that with my employee on a 50-50 basis or whatever kind of thing. It begins to start getting you into the realm of affordability and workableness. It's in a very efficient way of subsidizing, and yet it's not one that we talk about a whole lot. So that's just one of the things that that an exchange could explore. It's not the only thing. It's not the end-all and the be-all, but it's just, I say that to give you an example of ways that they may be able to determine methods of subsidizing that are highly efficient and maybe not as routine as what we've worked with in the past. The other area that's important in terms of the tenets about our larger reforms are the access and the delivery of services, changing the delivery system, and in that we're talking about the value purchasing, the transparency. There are bills afoot in this session, as you know, that relate to transparency. The 2213, which is the bill that requires insurers to provide customers with what their out-of-pocket exposure would be for different procedures, is an example of a transparency. The more we can do to bring the cost of services and the outcomes of services clearly to the light of the consumer, the better off we would be. And quite frankly, as we have our conversations around health savings accounts, and that being the choice of some people, I think in some ways we have the cart and the horse mixed up, because I think you have to have transparency in order for people to understand the cost that may come out of their pockets, in order for them to make decisions about value and how to best spend their money. So I think we need to constantly keep working on the transparency issues. And there are, again, other issues. The charity care reporting bills are related to transparency. The hospital and ambulatory surgical center quality outcomes legislation are related to that as well. So there's a variety of things readily available to us even this session to talk to these things. We also recognize that just having insurance doesn't mean that you automatically have access, and so the governor feels that we should focus on prevention and that it's important to maximize our investment into the safety net. And as Representative Greenlick knows, there's a whole raft of bills related to the safety net, and I was fascinated by the first attempt to merge those bills which ate a lot of paper. But nonetheless, there are important and salient issues within those that are important for us to look at. And I think it's also, we want to maintain a capacity for us to look at and explore new health design and health delivery mechanisms. So the talk about medical homes, et cetera, is healthy and should be continued to be fostered even as we go towards reform, or even as we quote-unquote think we complete reform. Finally, the other piece that's important is maximizing health or wellness, if you wish. And today, for those of you who may know or may not know, the Health Policy Commission has released its report on promoting physical activity and healthy eating among Oregon's children, kind of a long mouthful in terms of a title. But it speaks to a variety of recommendations that can be made. I think we're particularly concerned at the rising cost of and incidence of juvenile diabetes. And there are bills afloat also in the session related to the school food standards and physical activity. Beyond our schools, we also think that there are partnership opportunities within the workplaces and our own state programs to challenge the people in this state to adopt healthy lifestyles. It is one of the mysteries how to get people motivated to do that. And we have also been invited by the state of Washington to do an interstate competition with them towards becoming the healthiest state in the nation. And they have instituted Let's Walk a Million Miles in X period of time and have an internet-based system and so forth that we could potentially tap into and partner with them. So we think that that's important. We know employers have vested interest in that, and we want to find ways to creatively challenge the people of the state to adopt and maintain healthy lifestyles. With respect to the Oregon Trust Board that you've been discussing in your legislation, the governor is quite intrigued by that and sees it as a way to bring together the various interests that are working towards reform and to give us more time to work out a more explicit, more detailed pathway towards the next step of reform. It's interesting, in some of the conversations with the governor, we also made the observation and that we sometimes forget when we get into these committees and we get under the time frame of a session, but, you know, we think of health care reform as an absolute goal, that there's some golden state that we'll reach and then all will be well. And the reality is this is a process. It's not a goal, it's a process. And that we have to be able to constantly be changing year after year. So it's not like we're going to pass something this year or next year and then we don't have to visit it for a while. Healthcare, unfortunately or unfortunately, is one of those ever-changing, in-motion, constant kinds of systems. With respect to the pre-tax treatment of employer benefits, I think our major concern is to work very carefully with that and also to work in a way so that it does not further shift costs to working families who are struggling with the cost of their health care, and we do not want to change that in a way that directs the burden more heavily onto those families. By the same token, we recognize that we're coming to the time, particularly with all the job mobility, job changes, and so forth that we have in our society, where it's important to maintain the investment of employers in this social benefit, and at the same time, it may be getting closer to the time when we would relieve them from the hassle of trying to arrange all this for their employees. And some employers will want that, other employers will not, and so I think we have to create a flexible capability to handle that. With respect to Medicare and the proposal that Governor Kitzhaber has offered, I think the governor's thinking on that is that he agrees that, I mean, we all know Medicare is in trouble and we have to do something. However, Medicare, unlike Medicaid, is a totally federal program. Medicaid is a partnership between the states and the federal government. Medicare is totally federally funded. And we think that the forum, the right forum for that discussion, is at the federal level. However, that doesn't stop us from coming up with some decent ideas to feed into the federal process. And I think Governor Kitzhaber has done an elegant job of shining a light on the path in terms of clues for the feds in terms if they really want to do something about it. And I think he's really gotten to some of the crux of the problems with the existing system. But we don't see the people or the public or even us in particular wanting to see a variety of state versions on Medicare. I think seniors in this state and across the country enjoy the fact that Medicare is structured, it looks sort of the same across the boards, and I don't think anybody wants to see 50 different Medicare programs starting to evolve. And I think, other than that, I think these are the tenets that are essential from the governor's standpoint, his reaction to some of your discussions and to discussions that he's had with Governor Kitzhaber. I think he wanted to weigh in so that you would know where we stand and also to offer the support of our office in your efforts in any way that we can. I think that translates to I'll work with you any way I can possibly help you, and we will work together to see what we can do to keep us going along this path towards some place in the future where we'll feel better than we do today. With that, I probably would say thank you for giving me this time to present some of the governor's view. Somebody did say to me that this is he did go on a bit in his letter, and I think part of that is the enormity of the task that you've taken on. Part of it is the importance of the task that you've taken on. And the other part is when three staff people go to write a letter, all hell busts loose. And so we'll just try and do the best that we can. But we also wanted to cover all the major points for you and to give as clear a statement as we could so you would understand the governor's thoughts on these topics.
Well, Reed, first I want to thank you for coming here this evening, and I thank the governor personally for an 8-page comprehensive letter, which I really appreciated.
It was down to 6, yeah.
Well, if you go back to back, I think it's 8.
Oh, okay.
And I do, you know, as I read this letter this morning and again this evening, I see this as something that's really supportive of what we're trying to do, a collaborative effort, something that allows us to have a great conversation and end up with a better bill. And I hope you'll relay back to the governor. I'm writing a letter myself, too, of course, thanking him for this and thanking him for taking time to engage with us in this. Obviously, we need his support, and we are more than happy to give him our support on the issues he needs help with right now. We do not see how we can have any chance of success here if he's not successful with what we must do in this particular session. Having said that, I have several questions for you. I'm sure other members of the panel do, too. So I'm going to step back from my question, let others ask questions first, and I'll ask some questions in a few minutes. Men, do you have any questions?
Well, just first of all, a couple of comments, and as both Alan and I have expressed to the governor personally, as well as his, quote, healthcare staff, we without question support healthy kids and adding human beings back to the standard population, and the Oregon prescription drug program goes without saying. I have two maybe concerns with the letter, and I think probably the governor shares these concerns. And the first, he very accurately and articulately expresses the anxiety around change and around reforming how healthcare is delivered. Absolutely, it's one of our biggest challenges. So I do appreciate the way in which he framed that. But the other perspective that must be put on the record, and that we are all responsible for carrying, is that regardless of what we have today, we really have very little at all, because what we have is not sustainable. It will not continue, and that the only solution to salve that anxiety is fundamental reform or we will end up with very little. We're only the most wealthy and the most poor have access to health care, which is not acceptable to me, and I know that's not acceptable to the governor. The other thing is just the assumption that is all too frequently expressed, and that is with regard to employers, you know, all employers want to provide health care coverage, but they just can't afford it, is patently not true. There are some employers that are not the good corporate citizens that struggle desperately to pay the 20 to 22% of their payroll cost to provide health care coverage. Some employers in their business model just don't go to that step. So, you know, that's something that we've got to acknowledge. This committee has to address. The board, the Oregon Health Trust Board, and the modeling they come up with have to address the equity of shared responsibility for all employers and all employees. So with that, I guess I'd just leave it to the rest of the committee members to ask their questions. But again, thank the governor for his thoughts and the significance he has shown our efforts by his very thoughtful letter and your artful presentation.
Thank you so much.
Senator Morissette.
Thank you. Well, not so much a question, but I like the comments about the exchange because I think that's exactly what it will do is be a vehicle for pooling.
Bill?
And allowing them. Turn the microphone over.
Thank you. And allowing the small employers and individuals to, you know, to get what their needs are to have them met by the exchange. I don't see, and I'll have to read through this again, reference to the local models that will have to be established and the regional models and so on and so forth. And that's not the kind of letter it is. I think it's a letter of support in general, and I do like that particular section of it. I think that is what the exchange does offer. So
thank you, Senator.
Thank the governor for me, and I too will write a note.
Okay. Well, Ray, I guess it's my turn. I think the fact this is an 8-page letter or
it's
6-page or 7-page letter, you can argue as you wish about it. I think that speaks to the complexity of this issue. Even trying to sum up something of this nature and try to express some concerns and some support for what we're trying to do, you just can't get it down to less than 6, 7, or 8 pages. And for that reason, I think you can see that 329 is going to speak kind of broadly about some things and leave a great deal of the work to be done by a board over the next 12 to 18 months. There are too many details for this to be done in the legislative committee setting, but we can set the framework up for getting that done, and that's where we're really trying to drive this to. We're not going to give everybody every answer they want. There'll be, as Senator Westland said, safe harbors to have these discussions in, and subcommittees, which will then report to the board, and the board will report back to us with what I hope will be a comprehensive plan for a significant change in how we deliver health care in this state, both addressing 100% universal access as well as cost. And of course, we know those can't be separated. One drives the other. The letter itself, and this will be a question to you, talked a lot about value purchasing. I didn't see specific language about cost control. I saw some vague language about the delivery system. One of the things we believe we've learned in this process over the last 18 months or so is the importance of preventative and primary care and the loss of that in our system, which makes us significantly different than any other industrialized country. And we believe that loss and the high use of high-tech end-of-disease treatments is one of the major factors driving cost out of control and then in fact denying access to other people that can't get to the system at all. Were you alluding to that in this letter, or was that something that was not discussed?
No, I think we were alluding to it, and he actually, we do specifically mention preventive care. And I think one of the best values in medicine today is primary care. And so I think we do very much support that model. I think the other piece that I failed to mention that's in the letter as well is, we talk about value purchasing. Part of that is the idea that you would get the outcomes you're looking for. They would be health-based rather than procedure-based. And I think the governor feels very strongly that the set of incentives that we create in this new version, if you wish, have to support cost containment, evidence-based medicine, efficient use of resources, et cetera, and that the incentives have to be aligned to make sure that that's what's in the best interest of the players in the system throughout, both the consumers, the providers, the insurers, the safety net providers, et cetera, kind of thing. And I think that, to me, when I talk about value purchasing and what's under that umbrella, key to that is the whole idea of moving that set of expectations into purchasing specifications, RFPs, I hope we're not there, but just generally purchasing guidelines, what we're actually asking for, how we actually pay for things, I think is essential to really making reforms in the system and getting us to the point of cost controls. I think those, people look for cost controls and there's a whole, there isn't one particular thing. There are loads of things that we could do. The trick, I think, is to weave them in a way that makes common sense as well as practical sense and delivers the outcome you're looking for, too. And I think that's the work in the interim over the next 12 to 18 months of figuring out what is the pattern of that weave and how do we make it happen.
Thank you, Ari. The only thing I'd add to that is that if the board does the work we hope it will, they're going to come up with recommendations and possible solutions, which are going to be difficult. We may be talking about changing how providers are paid, mm-hmm. talking about changes in how consumers access the system as far as barriers to preventative care or barriers to specialty care, mm-hmm. or reversing those and eliminating them. These are some tough things if you really want to change the system.
Yes.
So I just want to make sure that gets back to
everybody. Yeah, no, we recognize that, and this is not an easy path by any stretch, and you're absolutely right. The length of the letter is partly about this is really hard stuff, and how you piece this together and turn it into a vehicle that does the kinds of things you want it to do is a huge, gargantuan task that'll challenge all of us, I'm sure. But it's also exciting to have the opportunity to work on that, to potentially have an impact, to take the next steps. And I do believe it's that we, you know, it's one of those things of don't let the perfect get in the way of whatever it is, the doable.
Good.
The good. Thank you.
The good.
But I mean, I think that's what we have to keep, one of the questions we have to ask ourselves as we go down this path together is, are we going in the right direction? Are we moving forward? Are we going in the right direction? Are we moving forward? Rather than, and I like very much the idea that your language you're contemplating is going to be broad and loose, so to speak, because I think that kind of flexibility is absolutely essential at this point in time. And we don't have, a written in stone recipe for this. We have to come up with, the parts of what I call the moving mosaic. That's what healthcare is. It's a moving mosaic with 1,000 little pieces that you have to figure out how they're relating to one another in order to get the full picture.
I agree. Senator Moore, say that again.
Thank you. He does mention the Oregon Prescription Drug Program and the imminent expansion of the program and in another publication.
Bill?
Sitting here.
I'm sorry. Another publication I'm sitting here raises the question, are we going to have a formulary in this program? Will the entity negotiate prices with the industry directly? I wonder, just opening up the thought of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program serving as the basis for drug purchasing and doing, if we decide to do a formulary and that sort of thing. I mean, these are on a convergence parallel track at this time, but hopefully they would come together because we will have the vehicle to be able to bulk purchase drugs for everyone in the state of Oregon.
And we are already working with a formulary in that program, and we'll continue to do so. And that is one possibility to see how that goes forward. So I think it's not an all or nothing, too. I think you have multiple choices of how you might arrange that into this picture, how it might be an option among options, or how we might take it even a further step from where we are today.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. I thank you for coming, and I really am very excited about the three initiatives that he has supported so strongly: the Healthy Kids, the restoring the Oregon Health Plan, and also the prescription drug program. But those all require more funding, more money, and maybe the governor would prefer for us to deal with utilization, with certificate of need, and with transparency. Has the governor stated exactly his vision for this session anyway on transparency, certificate of need, and utilization?
I think on transparency, I mean, one of the governor's priority bills is 2213, which is the insurance transparency piece. I think the recommendations within the Health Policy Commission's report related to transparency are also what we see as very good paths to take. I don't believe that the governor has specifically taken any position on CON at this point in time. And I think, frankly, CON, in my book, is not a key steering current to health care costs. I think the formula I always keep in my mind is price equals cost times, or cost equals price times utilization. To me, that's the fundamental formula in healthcare, and it's like, how do you tinker with each of those three elements? While CON pretends to be a supply side control, there are also many things that seep out from underneath the CON umbrella that are also there to avoid it. And so I think we have to think more carefully about reimbursement systems controlling overutilization than a regulatory program like CON.
Thank you.
Just to continue this for a moment, I have a couple other points real quickly. I want to make real clear that on the pre-tax benefit, we're not interested here in ending deductibility. The actual language is to capture the value of deductibility. The problem here is that those who get this tax advantage are the ones that are already receiving a benefit, obviously, and those who are paying for the tax advantage are often ones who do not have health insurance. That tax loss is most heavily felt by those who really can't afford insurance. The president's most recent attempt to deal with that was to give that deductibility to individuals, too. The problem is the individuals who need health insurance, that's not going to help them very much because they can't afford the insurance in the first place.
Yes, I'm reminded of a John Stewart program that was speaking to the president's design, which is, so in other words, we're going to take the taxes that we didn't pay and use those to purchase health care that we can't afford, was, I think, his analysis. And I think that's one of the things that makes the governor somewhat wary about the Medicare aspects under Governor Kitzhoffer's thing, is that we would ask the federal government for the value of the tax shelter, which amounts to dollars that weren't paid into the Treasury. And so it makes it difficult at a time when our partnership with the federal government is more about them scooping up dollars from the states rather than releasing dollars to the states.
Just want to be clear about that one point. The second point I'd like to be clear about is I picked up, you said that Governor Kitzhaber was leaving some clues for the feds, which makes me think the feds are clueless. Is that what you're trying to tell us?
I happen to think you're a man who is very articulate in phrasing things.
The point I'm trying to make here on the Medicare issue is this. One, I believe the bill will probably, although I haven't seen the final copy myself yet, will talk to a couple things in which it will point out that Medicare, in fact, is not a national program that is equal. It is far from equal. We are one of the bottom states in Medicare payments. People in the state have to pay a premium every month. Mm-hmm. They have to pay deductibles. In other states, they do not have to do that. And when I hear any national organization try to tell me that Medicare is an equal program across the United States, I have questions about that when clearly it is not. And there are some states in which the citizens of this country who all pay into the system do not get what other areas of the state get. And we need to remember that when we speak to this. We would be happy, and this bill will probably speak to it, to have just the average Medicare payment in the United States in this state. That would resolve most of our issues as far as this is concerned. So I want to make those 2 points be very clearly. Medicare is, in fact, not a fair national program, and we don't get our fair share. It's easy to sit in a state like New York and some parts of New York or Florida or other states with a heavy payment by Medicare and talk about equity and buying into pools when you've got that kind of background and support financially from states like Oregon.
Yeah, let's see. Are there more representatives in California, New York, and Florida put together or in Oregon? Oregon?
Well, I'm sure that doesn't
California,
drive
California, New York, or Florida?
I can't imagine that driving policy. Yeah.
Electoral votes. Let's see. Oregon versus California, New York, and Florida.
Let me do the math, Mitch.
It's a number that's bigger than 7, so I'm in trouble. Okay?
Well, I understand perfectly what you're saying, and my previous residence was in the state of Washington, which suffers. We're very close in that state to Oregon's position in terms of Medicare reimbursement. And before that, I lived in the state of Florida, where it's what I call the Godzilla of healthcare down there, and they get the highest on the globe. And certainly we understand that. I had the opportunity to attend an advisory committee meeting with Congresswoman Hooley recently, and we talked about this and the fact that $1.3 billion would come to the state if we could just get the average. Some of the same issues came up of, you know, who are we going to take that from? And so one of the fallback positions I offered was at least this recent round of proposed cuts from the feds to providers, that perhaps the lower 20% of reimbursed states could be exempted from that, seeing as how we're so efficient that we really shouldn't need to have our providers cut anymore. And that might be some way, at least, to do no further damage to us and cost them a little less savings rather than pouring out more cash, which they don't seem to be inclined to do. But I think Congresswoman Hooley took down notes on both of those efforts, and hopefully we'll maybe have some success.
Thank you.
Patches that aren't paid.
Yes.
Any further questions for Marie? Thank you for coming this evening. Appreciate your comments, and give our best wishes to the governor. Hope to see him soon, and thank him very much for the letter. I see it as primarily supportive of what we're trying to do here, and I appreciate his support for us, and we'll support him every way we can to get those bills through.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.
And Representative Greenlick, too, I look forward to having the opportunity in front of your committee to provide these this message as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Reed. Now I'll try to get these names correct. If I'm wrong, please feel free to come up and blame the good Senator Westland for this. Jim Quaid, Mental Health Director, Confederate Tribes of Warm Springs. Jackie Mercer, Executive Director, Native American Rehabilitation Association. Mike Nolta, Burns Paiute Tribe.
Anybody want to take a break?
Nope. So just identify yourself before you begin to speak, and we will be glad to hear your testimony this evening.
Okay. My name's Jim Quaid, and I'm the acting general manager of human services for the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs. I have been since 1999. I'm also the mental health director there. I've worked for the tribe for the past 23 years. I brought some testimony today from Chairman Supa, but if you believe in the old axiom that all politics is local, he can't be here today because he's up for election today. So he's home still campaigning.
We understand that. trust me.
I thought you would. We spent some time. This is by way of history. I think it's important to understand that the tribes in this state, as well as the tribes in this country, have been involved in providing universal health care for the last 15 years. They do this through the Indian Health Service. Many tribes have actually taken over Indian Health Service's functions, and that's referred to as, you'll hear this term a lot in Indian country, 63080. And that refers to Public Law 638, which allows tribes to take over a federal function and perform that on their own. It was self-determination and self-sufficiency was the goal of that federal legislation. By way of example, it would be somewhat similar to the idea that the state of Oregon would assume the responsibilities of the FBI, and that you could contract for that, and then the state would now perform FBI functions. That puts us in a very unique place when we talk about, in 1990 when we were talking about the Oregon Health Plan, and today when we're talking about health care reform. I've been through we've reviewed the most latest version of the Senate Bill 329, and that was the one dated that I had, 312-07. And I noticed in there that the definition of a safety net providers was added, and I'm assuming that was intended to include tribal programs and other safety net providers in the state, nonprofits, fairly qualified health centers, and the like. However, I guess what I would like to see is more specific definition about that, to actually name the types of providers that we're talking about in those categories. Along that line, when I looked at the composition of the Oregon Health Trust Fund Board, just for the sake of equity, I would ask that you include at least two representatives from the safety net health providers. The board seems, the current composition in this draft of the bill seems somewhat weighted to the private sector. And we, I think, at least tribes, have a different point of view about how to provide universal health coverage to a large population. The last point I want to make is the relationship, and this is probably the most difficult part. There's the idea, I think, in this, it's not stated there, but I'm assuming it, that an accountable health plan will be capitated in some way, and as a result of that, then safety net providers will come in under an accountable health plan. This kind of system will not work well for tribal programs or for the Indian Health Service operating here in the state. I assume maybe you're not aware, but the Indian Health Service maintains two clinics right now, one at Chemawa and one at Warm Springs. And these are full-service outpatient health clinics. And we had this discussion early on in the Oregon Health Plan that we could not contract with the providers for a variety of reasons. But underlying that are some other significant issues. And the first one is this. Both Indian Health Service clinics and tribes must provide services to Native Americans. They can't deny a Native American service. And that service is provided at no charge. Okay? That puts us in a very difficult spot when we're dealing with or we're associated with a capitated health plan or our services fall underneath a capitated health plan. Because the interest of a capitated health plan is to maximize their revenue and minimize their expenses. And what will happen and what started to happen, even in the early stages of the Oregon Health Plan, was the capitated health plan would see, oh, you're a Native American, go to Warm Springs. And if we tried to build a capitated health plan, they said, oh, you're not part of our network, we're not paying you. And that's what led to the changes in the Oregon Health Plan, the Native American section, was to avoid that conflict. And I see the same, I don't think anybody's intentionally doing it, but I see the same thing here again, that the potential for that conflict is there. And what I'm asking, or for everybody to consider, is that we tribes in the Indian Health Service be allowed to stand apart from that. That in the system, we can still continue to bill fee-for-service, or if there's going to be some sort of capitation plan, that it is the tribe or the Indian Health Service that somehow can work that out. The fee-for-service mechanism has worked very well, I think, for most tribes. There are, I can think of two tribes who have gone to the federally qualified health clinic status and have found that to work for them. But that's the uniqueness of their situation. What else do I want to say about that? Did I say it all? I said it all. I guess here's the other thing I want to say. I think you should, I'm just sitting here, you may want to get more input from tribes on the later on down the road. I realize what this bill is about. It's about setting up a kind of a committee to start getting to the details of things. And so I don't want to get into that, you know. But we have a lot of experience in providing universal health coverage. We're providing it now to approximately 20,000 Native Americans in the state. At Warm Springs, it's almost 6,000 Native Americans that we're providing the full range of services. And that's your outpatient, that's your pharmacy, that's optometry, that's dental, that's specialty care, that's emergency care, mental health, and alcohol and drug. Last year, you'll see in the testimony, we spent approximately $17 million. That was through our tribal health insurance plan, which is a way of subsidizing that. We're using health insurance for employees. And for people who don't have any coverage, we're negotiating contracts and paying for that directly for them. But that still comes up short. I think everybody's aware of this. It's not just the reform of the delivery system. It's the reform of the financing system. The way the system is financed today can't sustain the current health care system as it's operating in this country, not just in the state of Oregon. It's going to go bust. It's actually there. That's it.
Let me respond to a couple things for you that I hope you'll find reassuring. First of all, we've had a long experience with capitated plans across the state. They are all regionalized, and for very good reasons. There's one that's not, but the vast majority of them are regionalized because every region has different needs, and it works much better to have local control and regionalization, and you're in the same position. I understand also you also have, though, an off-reservation clinic in Portland, if I remember right. And so that's part of your system, too, you know, helping your Native Americans wherever they may be living. The other issue you've got is the cost, and we understand that also. I do not want this program in any way, shape, or form affect you in a negative fashion, okay? And if the board is set up properly with the subcommittees below it, which will feed it the information they need, those subcommittees will be putting together the actual, where the rubber meets the road, information about how they proceed, and that's where you could have your greatest impact. We would invite you to take part in that. Strongly take part in that.
Definitely want to be there.
We do not want to hurt the tribes. We want to make things better for the tribes. And you and I both know, I believe, that while you have a great universal system for access, you haven't got enough money in the system to fulfill the needs of a specialized population. A population that suffers dramatically from mental health and suicide and from alcohol and all the other maladies we see in our lives, hypertension, diabetes, a much greater risk for stroke and heart attack. So we do not want to hurt you in any way. And we would ask you to take part in those subcommittees and make sure the policy is put in place that we don't inadvertently do something that would harm you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you for being here. How do you identify Native Americans? I'm 164th Native American. Do I qualify? Probably not.
Sure. The Indian Health Service has rules for that, and you have to be a descendant. You have to be able to prove descendancy, or you have to have a certificate of Indian blood, or be enrolled in a tribe.
Okay. My second question, how do you deal with people from other parts of the country? I mean, I'm not talking state boundaries. I'm talking tribal boundaries. For instance, Blackfoot Indian from Montana, can they come over and get services?
Any Native American can come to the Warm Springs Clinic and get outpatient services.
Okay. Now, the thing that we're facing with our plan, of course, deals with some of those issues. I mean, how do we identify a resident, quote unquote? Are we talking an illegal alien who lives here? Probably for services. But I mean, these are kind of, they're things that we have to deal with. A certificate of saying that you are a Native American, and I imagine that goes by degrees. 164th doesn't cut it.
It depends. Each tribe has its own enrollment criteria.
Okay, so.
And that's what makes the determination. Each tribe determines that. And so if, for example, a person was a descendant, that tribe could determine that they were a descendant, but they didn't have enough blood quantum for enrollment. But they would still issue a certificate of Indian blood.
Okay?
Good. And okay. That would document descendancy.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. So no further questions.
For the record, my name is Mike Nolta. I'm here representing the Burns Paiute Tribe. I would like to read into the record a statement from the Tribal Council. We are one of the smallest tribes in the state of Oregon. We are isolated out in Harney County in rural eastern Oregon, which keeps us from a lot of services. Being one of the smallest tribes, we only have one page. We won't go into 7 or 8 pages, whatever that was. We'll just keep it short and succinct. So with your permission, I would read this testimony.
Please.
The Burns Paiute Tribe hereby recognizes that we have not been able to provide critical mental health services to our Native American people in our service area. The tribe does not receive any direct mental health funds from the state. Mental health funding is crucial to Native American tribes at this time. The state can do only so much for Native American people, and we understand that thoroughly. By giving the mental health funding directly to the Indian tribes, this will enable our programs to address the mental health issues that Native American people are struggling with. We deal with intergenerational trauma and unresolved grief, which create a myriad of other mental health problems such as PTSD, poor parenting skills, suicide, and on and on and on, which most of the high risk stats in the state are, we get to head that up, and that's a travesty. We need mental health service to deal with intergenerational trauma and unresolved grief, which is an area that we need to be treated by professionals who understand these issues of intergenerational trauma and unresolved grief and the outfall of that. We need mental health services on the Burns Paiute Reservation to help our people deal in a more culturally appropriate setting. Many Natives culturally do not feel comfortable speaking with non-Native providers about their personal problems. We request the state to make direct mental health funding available to the Burns Paiute Tribe and the other tribes in the state of Oregon. Point two. In the governor's budget, alcohol and drug services funding was being proposed in the amount of $125,000 per Indian tribe for alcohol and drug treatment, prevention, and the like, and infrastructure. We have been informed that this amount has been taken out of the recommended budget. The alcohol and drug funds continue to deplete, and our tribe cannot provide the alcohol and drug services that are desperately needed to help our Native American people. The Burns Paiute tribe provides these services in a very minimum budget. The recommended amount of $125,000 would help us build the needed infrastructure to develop a more comprehensive and culturally appropriate treatment services. The Burns Paiute tribe is asking that this amount be reinstated. Point three, in the response to the combining of health funds coming into the state, the Burns Paiute tribe recognizes the trust responsibility of the federal government, and the federal funding is on a government-to-government relationship. The proposed combining of federal and state dollars is not acceptable by the Burns Paiute tribe. We see this as a direct conflict with the sovereign rights of the Burns Paiute tribe. Again, thank you for letting the Burns Paiute tribe voice their concerns. Respectfully submitted, Wanda Johnson, Tribal Chair.
Thank you for coming here tonight, Mike. On the last point, I believe the bill is trying to go a little different direction than you might have thought. We're not talking about taking any of the direct funds, federal funds, that the tribe would receive as sovereign nations from the federal government. We're talking about OHP funds. We believe many of the Native Americans qualify for those funds, and a state and federal match will then be turned over to the tribes in addition to what you're already receiving from the federal government and fund programs that your people need so badly. Mm-hmm. So I don't want this to be seen as a takeaway, and we'll make sure that language is clarified in the bill. Is that are we talking about the same thing here?
That would suffice.
Okay, because what I read was there was a fear that we were going to take your federal funds and put them into a big pool. That is not the purpose of this at all. It's to bring in more federal match on the Medicaid program, which in turn would bring more to the tribes, not less.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yes. Representative Greenleaf.
I'm intrigued with the issue of the nation-to-nation relationship between the tribes and the federal government. What's the equivalent of that in the relationship between the tribe and the state government in terms of funding and a variety of other things? How does that relationship work?
Who wants to tackle that one?
Yeah, who wants to tackle
that? It's only taken us 150 years to get here. Maybe you can straighten us out this evening.
There is a government-to-government law that was passed. It was Senate Bill 770. And, you know, it
Please take a moment to identify yourself for us, please.
I'm sorry. Hi, my name is Jackie Mercer. I'm the CEO of the Native American Rehabilitation Association. So, you know, Representative Greenleaf, there was a state law that was passed that required government-to-government consultation. It doesn't require, as my understanding, the same level of commitment in terms of dollars that follow, but it requires consultation that Mike can correct me if I'm wrong, but it requires consultation on the part of the departments in the state if there's any issue that affects tribal interest in any way, whether that's health or land or whatever.
I can just follow up a little bit. I mean, the members of the tribes are also citizens of the state of Oregon, in a sense. So that there's a relationship between the state and concern for worrying about the citizens of Oregon. But then there's also the sort of nation-to-nation relationship. And I'm just kind of curious about how that facilitates or gets in the way of our ability to get the resources to the tribes that the tribes need to use to deal with the citizens of joint concern.
Let me give you an example of where it works and where it didn't, where it got in the way. One example of where it worked was last legislative session, we brought in a bill to basically expand maternal child health services. And it was very important because tribes were not able to directly access the Title V of MCH funds because they came to the state, and there was a state law there that said that the money should go to county health departments. We had passed that bill. We're working with the health department, state health department. We're developing a contract procedure, a formula procedure, so it'll conform with their federal requirements, and we'll get that done. Okay? That's where it worked. In the case of Warm Springs, the bill, I think it was Senate Bill 1 to create the Oregon Youth Authority, left out the words "and tribe." And as a result of that, we do not have the ability through our tribal court system to access the Oregon Youth Authority and those corrections programs. Okay? Because it would have required, what was required in that, what, how it's interpreted is only a state district court can commit to the Oregon Youth Authority and not a tribal court. That simple language, it isn't that we didn't want to pay our share or play by the rules, but that simple piece of language leaves us a huge gap in juvenile prevention, in juvenile corrections. We do not have, because the federal government does not provide juvenile corrections, you may or may not be aware of that. In other words, if a juvenile commits a federal crime, they have a great, it's almost impossible for the federal system to deal with it because they don't have any juvenile facilities. Generally, when they convict somebody, then they contract with the state, local state, and they place them that way. But we don't have that ability to do that. So if a juvenile commits a crime on the reservation, be a Measure 11 type of crime, armed robbery, it can only be treated as a misdemeanor by the tribal court. And that's a place where the government-to-government relationship hit a brick wall.
Thank you.
Did that clarify for you?
I'm going to ask our legal counsel to review the testimony you've given to us on these issues, and we don't want to inadvertently, you know, leave somebody off the table or make a mistake of that nature in this bill.
Okay, that's why you hear me saying.
Yeah.
Okay. I got some history with it.
Yeah. I hear in your voice that you're concerned, okay? And I ask you to look at the bill when it comes out carefully. The first bill out will be one for everyone to look at, look for errors, get as many fingerprints and eyeballs on it as you can. Please bring that back to us, okay? Appreciate it. Are we next?
Yeah, I think so.
I guess you're Jackie Mercer, correct?
Yes, I am. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I just wanted to say that Dee Pigsley from the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians had wanted to be here also and was going to submit some written testimony. If you've not received that yet, it should be coming in soon. So she just asked that we mention that again. I just want to say that it's very clear to me that the comments that, first of all, it's great to follow. People have already covered most of your points, so that's helpful. And secondly, it's always good to know that how well that you all have listened to the concerns that have been shared, both here and in other conversations in regards to several of our concerns. So really do appreciate that. I know that this is an important work, and I know that you all take it very seriously, and I'm really grateful for that. And I know it's really way more complex than what we even understand. And I understand that Senator Bates gave some of my disparity lecture, so I really appreciate that too, in terms of the numbers. But just a couple, just to cover them again, because I think they're just really huge issues. The diabetes, 3 times more likely for Native people. Alcoholism is about 2.5 times more likely, but the critical factor there, I think, is that a person is 700 times more likely to die from it if they're Native than not, which really reflects access to care issues and the depth of the issue. The other issue is, you know, Mike Nolte talked about with mental health issues, is that for Native youth 15 to 25, nationwide statistic is that they are 50 times more likely. This came from the Attorney General's the Surgeon General's report, not an attorney, is that it was Native youth 15 to 25 were 50 times more likely to commit suicide. So I think sometimes when you look at the package of the disparities, you can see that it really, there's huge disparities, and that the only way that really we're going to take care of them is to have a real commitment to that. And that doesn't necessarily mean one size plan fits all when it comes to this. So I'm very happy to hear, Senator Bates, of your interest and the committee's interest in not tapping into the Indian Health Service funds. We're an urban Indian health program. We get funding from the Indian Health Service. It's by design. They gave it to us to knowing that it would meet 22% of the perceived need. So when they designated the funds, it was with their understanding that that would happen, and that was in 1976. So things have changed a little bit since then, but the money has not really increased much. And there are, you know, in 19, I think it was 52, the first relocation acts happened, which were efforts on the part of the federal government to move Native people off reservations. So at that point, Portland became a relocation center. A lot of Native people were given, you know, a small amount of money, you know, $50, $100 and a bus ticket, and moved to Portland to relocate to be in the city area. It was another effort at termination of tribes and culture, and so when that happened, Indian people from all over this country moved there. So, for example, in last year in Portland, you have citizens of Oregon who live there that we saw in our health clinic from over 257 different tribes and bands throughout this country. So these are people who are citizens of Portland who live there, that are not traveling long distances to come to health care. I wish that we had the state-of-the-art clinic that they were doing that for. But in truth, you know, these are people who live in and around the surrounding area and come to our clinic. I think that one of the concerns that I had in reading the bill was just at what point to suggest that you all consider alcohol and drug treatment and mental health in that bill, so that parity is honored and alcohol and drug treatment is considered part of health care as it is now. And I'm sure that's something that you're considering. It's also good to hear your commitment to the Oregon Health Plan Standard coming back. As folks have talked here, it's really it's quite a burden. People with disparities that are adults have no access to getting the kind of services that they need, and you know, it is a huge issue. Life expectancy is about 65 for Native people and about 75 for non-Native people. So I think we all have different issues, different plans for our retirement than that. And so we're hopeful that, you know, as you're putting the plan together, that you will consider things that you've talked about also in terms of presence on the board, that there can be representatives, as you talked about, from tribes and other Indian people who can speak to the issues that are there and make sure that the plan is crafted from the beginning, is culturally competent, and not an add-on. So that's my story. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony tonight. Any questions for the panel?
Jackie, where did you hear that commitment to increase OHP standard?
I think I wanted to, Representative Green.
I do too, but I didn't hear it.
I believe that is the governor's letter. And Reeves Taylor's testimony and our support of that letter
we'll hold
$45 million for increase in the Oregon Health and Standard population.
Right.
Thank you.
Right.
And we're hopeful.
I wish that's all it took.
We are nowhere near where we should be or were at one time. We are trying to rebuild. This conversation this evening reminds me, this is a little bit lighthearted, but I hope you won't take it that way. We had a wonderful conversation with a woman who is a healthcare provider in Eastern Oregon talking about appropriate ethnic treatment for Native Americans, Latinos, and surprisingly, cowboys. And when we got all through that conversation after about 45 minutes, we clearly understood what was appropriate for Latinos and Native Americans and discovered that there was really nothing appropriate for cowboys. We had to leave it there. Okay, but thank you for coming tonight. I know some of you came a long ways. I appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chris Alanak.
The
I believe this is our last presenter this evening.
Mr. Chair?
My legs have given out.
Mr. Greenlee, thank you for coming tonight. With those knees, you're lasting longer each evening. We appreciate
it. Each evening, it's getting
better. You're a little better. Thank you. Good to see you again.
Harriet, run them harder on the way home.
Chris, you want to identify yourself and get started, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. I was asked to come here and talk a little bit about, I guess, the intersection of tax policy and health policy. And in particular, tax expenditures, I guess. And so what you have before you is just a two- or three-page summary that lists tax expenditures taken from the 07-09 Governor's Tax Expenditure Report, and they are grouped according to how they relate to health policy. And I guess the first one on the list there is the employer-paid medical benefits, which receives the most attention. And I just wanted to touch on a couple points about tax expenditures in general. Not every deduction or credit in the tax code is considered a tax expenditure. A tax expenditure is a subset of those. One of the key pieces to defining a tax expenditure is the assumption of what a normal tax base is, and that in and of itself is not clearly defined. Different people have different opinions about what that means. And how it relates to this one, the employer-paid medical benefits, these are the benefits that employers provide. And that estimate, the $910 million, is to say if the state were to start taxing those benefits, what would the revenue be that the state would receive? And that's the $910 million estimate. In contrast, businesses deduct the cost that they incur for providing those benefits, and that is considered a cost of doing business and is not included in the tax expenditure report. So those numbers, that the value of that deduction is a separate issue. So I just wanted to make that distinction as an example between the differences. Chris, and the only other thing...
go ahead. I want to ask a question about employer-paid medical benefits. So it's,
okay.
I want to make sure my understanding of this is correct, and we're not going to... to end that program, I'll start the conversation by saying that, okay. But as I understand it, if someone were to do that, if the deduction was lost, it would probably be moved into the expense column for a business if they needed to pay a premium, and then it would become a taxable benefit to the employee. Is that correct?
That's one possibility. Now we're talking about the employer's not...
Assume the employer is paying a premium.
Right, and they were no longer allowed to deduct that.
Correct.
Cost. The behavior there could go a number of different ways. It could be that employers would convert that value over to wages and just give that entire amount to employees, because from the cost of doing business, the employer doesn't care how much goes to wages and how much goes to benefits, as long as they're both deductible. If one becomes not deductible, then the incentive is to increase wages, to essentially increase the compensation toward the deductible aspect of that compensation. So the behavioral responses there could vary.
And the choice could be also to just stop paying the premium?
They could choose
and not raise wages.
And
the choice could be to move it to expense column,
pay it,
but then it become taxable to the individual.
Yes.
Those are the three options, basically.
At least three
major ones.
Yes.
Okay, I want to be clear on that, what we're talking about. And having said that, I'm going to say again, we're not doing that, okay? Go ahead.
The other piece that I was just going to talk about briefly was the mechanism, I guess, for which some of these tax expenditures or how they're carried out. And they're all through the tax form. This particular one, just running with that one, is an exclusion. So that never appears on the tax form. It's transparent to the IRS and to the State of Oregon Department of Revenue. It just doesn't show up anywhere. It's an exclusion. Other items, like the self-employment health insurance, is a deduction. So there is an amount written on a tax return that shows how much the employee or the person can deduct from their taxes. And another possibility are, the other two possibilities are subtractions and credits. A subtraction is very similar to a deduction. A deduction, as used here, is an element of federal tax code. And then a subtraction is an element of Oregon tax code. They are both cases where a certain amount of income is removed from taxation. Basically, the income is not taxed. The other possibility is a credit. For example, the rural medical practice credit is a dollar-for-dollar amount where the taxpayer goes through, they calculate their tax liability, and then they subtract dollar-for-dollar the amount of whatever credits they have. So a $100 credit is worth substantially more than a $100 deduction or subtraction. And so any policy changes that the committee were to consider with respect to how health policy and tax policy intersects, on the tax form, the deductions, credits, subtractions, the information is there, so it's relatively easy in terms of administration. Anything that would affect an exclusion would change the nature of the reporting somehow, because it would need to be reported to the various administrative agencies to track that information. And so with it, I wasn't going to go through each of these items individually, but if you had any questions, I'd be willing to answer them.
I have a quick question on long-term care insurance. Is that means tested at all? Is that credit available to taxpayers in any income tax bracket?
Chair Bates, I believe that's correct. I believe it's not means tested.
Okay.
You believe it's what?
Not means tested.
So if an individual has a very high income and is purchasing long-term care insurance, that can be deducted as a credit against their income tax for the state?
Correct.
Could you get back to me on that?
Sure.
Thanks. Double check that to make sure it's correct. Okay.
Well, you should know, Chris, that Jane Ellen is in the back row agreeing with you.
Agree.
Okay. So I'd be very suspect of your answer.
And the reason I'm asking that question, again, it falls in the same category as deductibility for health insurance. Those who make the most have an opportunity here to get a credit against your taxes. Those that can't, if I'm understanding correctly, those who can't afford to buy this kind of insurance don't get it, and so they, in a way, are having a higher tax burden because the credit's going to be somewhat of higher income, if I'm understanding this correctly.
Chair Bates, that's correct. And even on the folks who claim the credit, if their liability isn't sufficiently high enough, they aren't able to utilize the full amount of the credit. There's kind of that theme throughout many of the tax provisions. Any deduction is, if I'm following your line of thinking correctly, any deduction or subtraction is worth relatively more to higher income folks. Now, this is true more so at the federal level than at the state level, because at the state level you get to the 9%. We have the rates are 5.79, and you get to the 9% pretty quickly. But at the federal level, it's a much more progressive system where the rates range from 10% to 33% now, I think. And so at the high end, any deduction for somebody in the 33% bracket, they're saving 33% of their taxes. If somebody's in the 15% bracket, they're only saving 15%.
This says credit.
Yes.
This is even more significant.
Yes.
And shifting to the lower income,
yes,
or income individuals or middle income individuals who can't afford to buy the premium, those who can are shifting that credit.
Yes.
Thank you. I just want to make sure I understood. That's all. Any other questions? This is the kind of thing that, you know, at this time of the year, especially April 15th coming, can really, you know, cause some migraine headaches to the side of the table.
Yes.
These are issues that I've read on a great deal before and are not real new to me. Are there any questions from the panel about these?
Well, I just think we need to emphasize that, in addition to Chris's good work here, is what the bill really says in terms of, we see these big numbers here, and what the bill says is capture the value, not eliminate any of these specific deductions. or in this case exclusions or deductions. So, I mean, it's a little bit of apples and oranges. These are numbers that, you know, would, could, and should be captured, but we're not eliminating, you know, in particular the deduction. So,
I'd be particularly interested in HSAs, not for discussion, but MSAs. From the point of view of this is a great safe harbor discussion again for the board to look at, because I think those are programs which potentially have an ability to help hold on health care costs as the individuals have some choices in how they spend those monies.
Mm-hmm. And actually, Chair Bates, just to throw the discussion about means testing, the additional medical deduction for elderly, there is currently in the House Revenue Committee a bill that would, to some extent, means test that subtraction.
Thank you. That's reassuring to hear. Any further questions? Chris, thank you. Thank you for coming this evening.
Eye-opener.
Yeah, I was a little surprised about one, to tell you the truth. I thought I knew this stuff pretty well, but obviously there's always something new to learn. Thank you, Chris. I'll make sure nobody from the audience wants to speak this evening. Don't want to cut anybody out. Remember, there's no meeting Wednesday night. We're going to have a special on-the-road trip for the full Ways and Means Committee in Oregon City, I believe, Wednesday night. So we won't be here. We'll be back again 1 week from tonight on a Monday night again. Thank you for your attendance, and have a nice evening. We are adjourned.